This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the School of Influence podcast, where the queen and king of influencer marketing, authors and professors Amanda Russell and Neil Schaefer, cut through the noise and dissect what makes brands and professionals influential. No fluff, just the real deal.
Welcome to another episode of the School of Influence podcast. As always, we have a very special guest for you today, Dave Alberga. And as common, this is the first time I'm meeting Dave, so I'm excited as well as you are. But Amanda, I'm going to hand the mic over to you so you can give our introduction.
Awesome. I'm really excited to have Dave Alberga here, who is a serial entrepreneur. He has assisted in the launch of numerous startup organizations into their growth into very large companies. He is one of the founding investors of Peloton. And he also led the Active Network from pre-revenue to a sale of $1 billion to $1 billion exit for investors. He also served as the COO of City Search, City Guide, up until their IPO. And he serves on several boards. He has a background in military academy at West Point. And he's an overall awesome person and one of the go-to people for all things life advice. And if there were a real person life coach, I would point him to Dave. So I'm very excited to have you. But Dave, I actually learned things reading your bio that I didn't know. And I was like, how old are you? Because you've done a lot more than I even realized. And I kind of wanted to learn a little bit about sort of your journey. I don't know if you started out to be an entrepreneur. I know you have a background in military, but if you want to tell us a little bit about sort of how you got to the point of where you are.
Yeah, sure. First of all, thanks for having me, guys. Nice to meet you, Neil. How did I get here? A bit of a random walk, to be honest. I went to West Point, became a military officer, an infantry officer. When I got out of the military, I ended up at Procter & Gamble's. And I was basically like schlepping around a steamer trunk full of maxi pads from grocery store to grocery store. And I did that for about 3 years. And I decided that was really probably not what I wanted to do long-term, although I had learned a tremendous amount at P&G. So I ended up at grad school and went to business school. And then post-business school, I rolled out of there and went to the Boston Consulting Group for a number of reasons. But it was a great experience, but I was also ready to do a startup after a couple of years at BCG. And so I found myself back in the Valley, tied up with some classmates, and then since then have been really starting three companies since then, including one that was, I would have to categorize as kind of a C-, my first one. The second one then was City Search, which, you know, was a really great success. And then the third was the Active Network or Active.com, which I thought I was going to be at for 2 or 3 years. And in the end, it was a 13-year slog to about $500 million in sales, but a great exit for people. So it doesn't seem like that great an exit under today's market conditions. Like 2x revenue seems like, oh, what a deal. Today's market conditions, I think it probably would have been worth a lot more, but it's fine. It was a great experience. So I don't know if that answered your question.
It does. And the Active Network, just to give people an idea, like, can you explain a little bit? Because I didn't even realize how big the Active Network was and how it was kind of like, it was a game.
Yeah, sure.
For the industry, for all of sports, really?
Yeah, we really started in triathlon, just essentially building tools for people who organize triathlons. So think of us as kind of the Ticketmaster of triathlon, but with kind of a more robust backend with a lot of management tools for the organizer. So it included registration and transactions and things like that, but then it had a very deep backend for managing the event itself. realizing pretty quickly you couldn't build a terribly big company in just endurance sports, although I think we had about 50,000 customers in endurance sports at the time that the company sold. We then expanded pretty quickly into other things. So we ended up doing all the hunting and fishing licensing, automating hunting and fishing licensing in like 35 states. We automated campground reservations in like 30 states. And then the National Park Service and the Forest Service and the Corps of Engineers. We moved into corporate events and did everything from very small little events that you would self set up on and do your registration and management of your attendees, all the way up to, you know, Oracle Open World, managing all of Oracle Open World and all that that entails. So very, very deep functionality that's very specific to the vertical in which we were operating. I guess the other areas, you know, look, we automated schools particularly for after school activities. We automated churches. So it turned into it was kind of funny because from day one, everyone was asking me, well, how big can this really be? Right. Because no one really wanted to give me money. And they were like, well, how big can this be? And even candidly, at like $400 million in sales, they kept looking at me like, well, how big can this really be? I was just like, at what point do I have to stop answering this question? Which is really interesting about, and part of the reason the company ended up the way it did is that to a great extent, we were kind of flying under the radar and people didn't understand the sheer number of transactions that we were automating. So I'll give you an example. I think, I don't know if it was probably the largest sector in which we operated was automating your local parks and recreation department. So billions of transactions a year going through all these different types of activities that everyone kind of sees through transparently, unless you really get them focused on it or you're in the business. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone that's ever gone to a sporting event or signed up for a racer or whatever has used it, not even realized probably. So, but what I think, you know, our audience is marketers and entrepreneurs, and, you know, we specialize in influencer marketing. And I've talked to you about this several times about it really not being about social media advertising, but what you've been able to do is grow a company, right? How do you influence is taking over a space, having influence over the market, and on a couple of different levels. One is the ability to grow a company. And you talked about some of your special skill set. Like, how is it that no matter what the idea is, I mean, your companies have been all over the map in terms of like what the widget is, the ability to scale and put teams together. And do you think it's a genetic trait or like what is it about your, like whatever you touch to be able to scale team and bring it to?
Yeah, look, I readily admit I'm not a product guy and you don't want me leading your product team. I learned through my military experience. I mean, I guess for lack of a better term, I learned how to lead people effectively through my military experience. I think everyone thinks the military is about giving people orders. It's really not. People follow you if they like you and respect you and believe they're better off with you, and really for no other reason. And so I think what I did, and I kind of backed my way into this, is I figured out that's what I was good at. And so I applied that to building really capable teams. And in some sense, spending enough time looking inwardly and understanding what I was good at and what I was really not that great at, and hiring teams to ensure that they were great at the things I was not great at personally, that I was not going to carry the water on, and stick to the stuff that I was really good at, and then go kind of paint a target for those teams and motivate those teams and get them moving in the same direction. That's what it turns out I'm really good at. And candidly, like, not a lot else. So I'll give you an example, right? And this is kind of maybe the ultimate example of it, which is, not surprisingly, I built like my friends tell me I collect interesting people. I really value my personal network. I don't build it for any other reason than my own self-interest. I try to collect really interesting people who are kind people who are doing interesting things, smart people. As part of that process, you end up building a really great network of folks who are doing interesting things. So I was in New York on business for Active at one day, and I end up linking up at the end of the day with John Foley, who is now known as the founder of Peloton. But the reality is that, you know, he had built City Search with me a number of years before as a leader at City Search. And then he had gone to Barnes & Noble and a couple of other things in the interim. And he came to me and said, I got this idea. This is what I'm going to do. No one will give me any money, essentially, is what he said, right? Will you put some money into this? A couple of friends had committed to him already. And candidly, very honestly, I'm really open about this. I didn't think the idea for Peloton was that great an idea. I was kind of not blown away by the idea, but I had always been blown away by John. And I knew who John was and what John was about and how driven he was and how hard he was going to work. And if anyone was going to make a go of this, it was going to be John. And he was going to figure out where the business was. And so I invested in John. I didn't really invest in the idea of Peloton. I don't know if I'm the only guy who thought it was kind of a crummy idea, but I definitely am not the only guy who believed in John, right? And John has willed that thing to what it has turned into. And I think everyone thinks of it as an overnight success. He's been at that a long time. And it was successful because of John and the team that he built. It always ends up coming down to people.
Yeah, I love when you talk about this because I feel like that is what so much of what real influencer marketing is it's not an overnight. It's like building this network of people because, and marketing in general, it's so hard to measure. Like, how do you measure that? How do you measure like the return on a partnership, return on a friendship, return on your network? Because you can't, you don't walk into a party and you're like, will you be my friend? Because I can offer you X, 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 and you can offer me X, X, X. It wouldn't work that way. But there's like flywheel effect.
Yeah, that's interesting. Let's talk about that just a little bit in that I'm on social media, but I'm not a big consumer of social media. I don't really count who number. I could not guess as the number of followers I have on social media. I don't know. I don't pay any attention to it. To me, followers on social media is kind of empty calories. And look, I understand that it is for a certain set of folks. It's actually, you know, it can be a money generator, particularly if you can connect those folks with a consumer brand. That's just not what I'm about. I'm not about building a following and trying to connect them with a consumer brand. So it's just not that interesting to me. And I don't think I'd be very good at it. And I don't think anyone cares about what my opinions are on consumer brands, right? So to me, my social media is a collection of really accomplished, smart folks who are working hard and trying to build things and creating jobs. So to me, that's my influencer hemisphere. It's not a broader hemisphere of folks who I don't know and who I don't have a close connection with. So what I guess it's a roundabout way of saying, look, you know, I don't really think of myself as an influencer, to be honest. Maybe that goes to my personality. I think we potentially all are influencers within, you know, our expertise and our hemispheres. And mine just looks different than most, but it's really been critical to the success of my career and the success of my investments.
Yeah, it's different, but I think it breeds true influence. I mean, there's influence in different categories, but like when you're the guy that you know, everybody wants on their board or everybody goes to for advice or everybody goes to for like, even the person that I go to when I'm like, ooh, there's an idea. What do you think about like, what do you, and you break it down in so many different ways. I mean, how do you get to be that, you know, that's the ultimate influence.
First of all, thank you. That's a really nice thing to say. So I tell people pretty often that in business, miles matter. So I really believe, and I'm sure there are folks for whom they don't buy into this or they don't at least view it as important as I do. But I think the vast majority of success in business is about pattern recognition. Look, there are lightning strikes occasionally and people are really, you know, and some people are really good about getting hit by lightning multiple times. So it's not coincidence, right? But I'm not the lightning strikes kind of guy, right? I'm kind of the 3 yards in a cloud of dust kind of guy. And as a result, my belief is that most businesses survive or thrive based on their leader's pattern recognition. And so I constantly am advising people that who say they want to get out and start a company or they want to be an entrepreneur to not necessarily be in a huge hurry. The vast majority of companies fail, and they fail principally because either it was a bad idea or their leaders just couldn't manage around all of the challenges that come your way. And the reality is if you're in business for 15 or 20 years before you go start your first business, you got pretty good pattern recognition if you've spent it in the right sectors, right? And taking that pattern recognition into a startup is really invaluable. It also really helps raising money, right? It's much easier to raise money when you can show investors that you've developed really good pattern recognition over the years. So for those young folks who are really interested in becoming entrepreneurs, I always tell them to pump the brakes a little bit. Like I want them to be excited to go start a business. But there's nothing wrong with going into a great company surrounded by great people and getting really terrific experience that is going to pay off for you when you actually do go launch your company.
I'm curious, this concept of pattern recognition. I don't want to get like too philosophical here. Just out of curiosity, How would you compare that to something, say, historical perspective? I know that obviously this is taking it one step further and doing analysis and finding those patterns, but is it a little bit that you have to have that, that history under your belt in order to be successful? Is that, the core of it, you think?
So I don't want to, it's not cut and dried. And there's certainly, look, there are 18-year-olds out there who've built really valuable businesses, right? But I kind of think of that as they're a lot smarter and more genius kind of than I am. They've got some kind of a genius spark and they can see something that I would not be able to see in advance. But that's not the majority of businesses, right? That's what we see in the headlines. But I think the vast majority of successful businesses are kind of built day in and day out, just building your customer base, building great products, and lightning doesn't really strike, right? So I think I'm getting at what you're asking, which is, I think it's very difficult to know let's put it this way. Let's put it on a more positive side, which is to say that with really good miles under you, you start to see the exact same patterns forming over and over again in business. And this is kind of proven out to me. I'm not sure if I really recognized this while I was running companies, but now that I'm sitting on multiple boards and investing in companies and advising CEOs, it's become just patently clear to me that you just keep seeing the same patterns over and over and over again. And so in my role now as helping folks build their businesses, sometimes it's just super easy. Like I walk in and they say, well, this is what we're faced with. I'm like, oh yeah, I've seen this before. Here's what you do, right? And so you can kind of shortcut stuff for folks when you've got the number of miles on you that I've got.
So what would be like an example of like a pattern of some of these brands like a Peloton or like, X product that gets this cult following, whether it's a B2B or B2C, what are some of the, that you think that set it apart from like the millions of others? That it's not that they've worked harder necessarily. There's been a million others that have tried and worked and failed and couldn't get to that level.
What's the difference between being successful and not being successful? yeah, I got to tell you, if I could bottle that, I think
some of the contributors.
I think number one, there's a lot of luck involved. And entrepreneurs who don't tell you there's a lot of luck involved are kidding themselves or kind of, a little bit out over their skis from an ego standpoint. There's a lot of luck involved. I think that there is a lot of what I term professional will involved. What I've seen over and over again is that successful companies can, this is not a new phrase, right? And I don't know the exact, I'm going to paraphrase, but there's a million ways for a company to, a million things that'll kill a company. And there's like three successful paths it could take over those million, right? And so it's really the leadership's job to figure out how to marshal a team to go find those three successful paths. And I can tell you that there are multiple times where myself and my senior team from Active went to lunch thinking the company was done. Like, this is our last lunch. Like, let's just enjoy it. We're done, right? So, I don't know. I've never been associated with a business that didn't nearly go into the back of a bus multiple times. And the difference between the ones that survive that and the ones that don't is really a function of the leadership and kind of two subcategories under that leadership. One is this pattern recognition and being able to see it coming a little bit further in advance. And the second is what I term professional will. Like, you're just going to will something over the goal line. You're just not going to give up no matter what. And I think, I don't know if I can say this definitively, but I think a lot of companies fail because of a lack of those two things. Like, they didn't see it coming and they kind of gave up a little too early because they just did not have enough fear of failure.
Yeah, it is. I sort of want to switch gears a little from being a leader to before you begin to invest in a company or, in the past start a company, were you also using the same concept of pattern recognition to decide which companies to invest your time in?
So I kind of go back to the Foley story, which was I've figured out that, look, there are people out there who are friends and I know well who are really good at identifying trends, market trends and product trends. I'm not great at it. It's just not in my DNA, or it's not in my training. And I can probably blame the military for that or something. I'm sure there's someone I can blame for that, right? My parents or the military, someone, it certainly can't be my fault, but I'm just not really good at it. So for me, I have focused on investing in people, many of whom I've worked with in the past, because I can see that they bring both capability and this professional will. Like, I know they are not, like, look, not every business can be successful. But what I want is, I want to invest in someone who is going to go down swinging, right? And So I've invested in businesses that have failed, but they were bad ideas. It wasn't the entrepreneur's issue. It turned out they weren't great ideas. In the end, the thing that has been most indicative of success for me is a sit down, like an hour long sit down I do with the entrepreneur. And do I walk away saying, that's a woman or that's a guy who is going to drag this thing to success? Because there are going to be really tough times between now and an exit, like near extinction events. And is this someone I think has the DNA to make it through a near extinction event? I don't know if that makes sense, but that's how it kind of works for me.
No, it does. And in fact, everything you've talked about is very person-centric, which is actually very refreshing. And I think that, you know, as Amanda and I talk about influence in various formats, it does come down to the trust and relationships. Obviously, when we talk about, you know, social media influencers, there's trust at scale there and relationship at scale. But, you know, so much in business comes down to these core things that often we forget about because we're always looking elsewhere for advice or for answers. So it makes clear sense.
You know, Neil, it's interesting because I don't think it scales. That's the problem, right? So I have lots of friends who are venture capitalists and their personal networks run out. And so they can't just invest in people who they have real good experience with and who they know really well. They often do. That's why they continue to invest in people time after time after time, the same people time after time.
Gotcha.
But when you've got $1 billion to put to work, the problem is I don't think that approach scales and you've got to be better at identifying products and trends than I am. But at my scale, it works great.
What is it, the Dunbar number? There's only a certain finite number of people that you can have a good relationship with over life.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't heard a name put to that, but that's right. I think I might be pushing up against the boundaries, but I got to kick someone off every time I bring someone in now. It's a tough...
Amanda, watch out.
I know. I better keep making sure I'm interesting. I have to say, that's interesting. You don't think influence scales. And I do think it's interesting that I think that brings the point of, and you know, there's a certain topic that I talk about in terms of like influence in different arenas or different for different decisions, right? And how it's not universal. So I do think that it can scale based on the level of involvement of the decision. So if it's choosing, you know, a bathing suit, or you know, a low involvement decision that's not going to affect your life that much, then you're going to have more trust in somebody that you know. It depends on it's so contextual.
No, I completely agree with you. I think when it comes to consumer,
yeah,
and that scales, right? And I think it's been proven out over and over again that scales. So what it ends up looking like a year from now, I don't know if it looks the same. It probably doesn't. But I think influencers at the consumer level is a great business model.
And I think what you're talking more about influence is really influence in building your career. And like, you're right. You can't really scale influence on people trusting you.
Did you call it the Dunbar? What did you call it? The Dunbar number or something?
I forgot. And I might've just been taking that, you know, I think there's some number. I wrote these books on LinkedIn back in the day. And just this number of there's only so many people that you can keep in close touch with and build relationships with. And it sort of is a finite. So you don't even need 500 connections to get there. It's like, I think the number was like 200.
No, that's really interesting. There's only so many people you can have a really meaningful relationship with, right? And I kind of seek out the meaningful ones. I'm not interested in connections for connection's sake because it doesn't really work to my strengths anyway, right?
Yeah. And you've actually said that many times and it's helped me in terms of that. Like, I don't care about a connection. I'm not going to take somebody's call just to chat. And there's only so much time in the day. Like it's just like wasted energy.
I've said this before and it sounds really obnoxious, I guess. And it's not meant to be obnoxious, but there are people in my life who I really, really adore and I don't have time for them. Right. And so if I find an extra hour somewhere, I want to spend it with someone who I already know. This is a really enriching relationship and I'd like to give back to that relationship, not a new one.
So interesting. It's almost the opposite of the culture now, collecting as many followers, people that, you know, I think this has been a really interesting interview because it comes back to that principle of like, at the end of the day, like it's the relationships that you get the most value out of are the closest ones. And those are also where you're going to get the biggest intangible benefits. Like, I mean, on a piece of paper, who would have said that, you know, how do you get a stake in a company, you know, that's now taken off or whatever. It wasn't like you went into it being like, this is what I'm going to get out of this.
I built a friendship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really interesting, even at the consumer influence level, that those, you know, people who want to be influencers, as they get a bigger following, it's impossible for them to keep in touch with every single person that sends them a private message, right? But when you're just starting out, you have the ability to do that and really invest in those relationships.
Yeah, there's some curve there. I think if you develop the algorithm for that curve, it would be interesting, right? Because those, in the end, those are the influencers you want to find who are at the top of that curve, right? Or at the apex of that curve, or where it flattens out. Maybe it's not the apex, but it's where it flattens out. Because I bet, I wouldn't be surprised if there's not a kind of a junk bond kind of approach to that, which is you've got influencers who are underappreciated and underpaid, who are actually more influential than they know and then the market is recognizing. Because as they get much bigger, their influence actually goes down.
That's true. And you're recognizing a pattern, Dave. You're recognizing a pattern of, as we see social influence increase, there's a point of diminishing returns and conversion of product.
There's another thing that happens, and Amanda, you've probably seen this, where influencers, once they build that influence, they often end up spreading out into other products, and they get that influence gets diluted as they work more with brands, because that's where there's money, right? And the brand is sort of forcing them into other things, and they're taking the money. And that's another reason why that influence dilutes as they build a bigger following.
You know, when I was at BCG, I fell in love with drawing curves, mostly because of a partner I worked for there, who was really, really tough to, great to work for, but really demanding. And he used to say, let me show you one of my favorite curves. I'm telling you, there's a curve here that you guys can start to figure out that helps people understand where their greatest influence is. The interesting thing is that it might be most useful, unfortunately, probably for the buyer, right? For the company, for the brand, because now they can go find people who are essentially undervalued, right? That would be interesting.
Yeah, they exist for sure. Well, I mean, we give them labels like nano influencer, micro influencer, Amanda, label aside, no. But you know, Dave, it's been a really great conversation just about, you know, we talk about influence in business, and we never really talk much about people and relationships and networking and these core things that are so fundamental. And Amanda, I'm reminded, like Jesse Itzler and his talk of those relationships, that the people you meet in your 20s become so influential over your life if you tap into them and keep those relationships, right? So just really great reminders. You know, Dave, I'm wondering, if I'm an interesting person and I wanted to get in touch with you, how can people listening, do you have any outlet where you share your views, or you keep things pretty, you know, hey, I have a new investment, new company.
Amanda can speak to this.
He doesn't want to be found.
Okay. I get it.
I'm pretty private, but with that said, I do respond to folks who I think are doing, you know, again, for lack of a better word, interesting things. So you can reach out to me on LinkedIn. I get reached out to a lot, so I can't guarantee I've got the bandwidth to answer all of it. But if you're doing something really interesting, I do tend to get in touch.
Awesome. That's what I want to hear. Thank you so much.
Give a fantastic pitch and then I'll pass it along. There we go. No, awesome, Dave. Thank you so much for it's always an interesting conversation. So thank you.
It's my pleasure. It's been fun. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, appreciate the time.
Thanks for listening to the School of Influence podcast. Amanda and Neil would be honored if you spend a minute to write a review wherever you are listening to this podcast to help expose these interviews to a broader audience. Make sure you hit the subscribe button so you don't miss out on future episodes. Even better, build your influence and ours by sharing this podcast on your favorite social media with hashtag School of Influence. We would love to hear from and engage with you.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Heiler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.